Right.
But quick, can I just ask a question here? So Matthew,
and y'all, we have some callers too that want to get in. But go ahead.
Okay. Ronnie. Okay. You said that there's no follow up, but what do you do in the case where it's not even about follow up, but that you have a party in opposition will say one thing and then allow the same process after the same public accounts committee? The example that we were just talking about that recently happened in the estimates process in Barbados.
And that becomes letting the foxes, manage the foxes, right? That is so that's why we also have to look at an independent body, organization, the work of civil society, the work that you and Ronnie and Cynthia are doing is crucial, because you have to have outside sources. The reality though is that there are few organizations other than Transparency International that have the funding and the sustainability to continue to follow and manage those things. There are places you can raise things in regional and both international forums, but the reality is it's few of us organizations that are there. My organization is not one of the gotcha organizations. We're in the business of trying to change systemic issues and get in front. When we see an instance of corruption, we realize we've already made tremendous mistakes. We need to get in front of that. We need to make sure that that doesn't happen again, regardless of administration, because political parties and elected officials have a tendency to support political parties and elected officials. The citizens require representation that becomes more independent in this mechanism. So that's why we've supported and advocated for the last years about the adoption of and the push forward of this bill to make sure that there are independent folks who are able to see and receive it. And we have to then work again with the citizens to exercise their muscles, exercise their voices, become more comfortable in this space, find ways to work together to bond with either organizations or with other citizens in civil society or private industry, so that they have the comfort of not feeling like it's individually
that falls on one person's shoulders
to raise these issues, right? Yeah, it has to be that there's a collective, strong, and comfortable voice and space to be able to raise things with a likelihood that those things will be gone. What we see is that widespread across, and this is that number, four out of five folks would feel that if I raise this issue, it's going to come back and hurt me or my family. That means we've become complacent, or if not complacent, that's probably the bad word, we've become saturated with the fact that our voices don't collectively change matters. But the component is that's what we have to work on. Is that's the cycle that I think we can start to show traction on. And the benefit is that's why we focus on integrity. It doesn't have to be people's charge becomes, you're going to be the ones to run down, those who get away with corruption. But the truth is, if we push for integrity in our public service, in our public life, and we maintain that as a standard that the public requires, many opportunities happen. We adopt technology and become more streamlined. We ensure that public funding is being used effectively and appropriately. We adopt open and transparent systems. People, in our countries, as they pay taxes, they want to know that those taxes go and benefit themselves. We have the capacity to ensure that systems that are put in place for the most vulnerable are the ones that we are calling for and changing. Right. That education becomes a crucial component, not the substantiation of a few folks who have access to get large government contracts.
Okay. Thank you so much. This is a really rich discussion. I would like to see if we can just squeeze in one call before we go to the news at 12:30. Good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Well, this is Prastak Sunday.
My friends is really up. Laws and the interpretation of laws cause of sort of ethics. Who you know and who knows you? Who investigates who? We have had a two-party system, DLP, 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 DLP. They all identify the problem when they're opposition. When they get there, the problem continues. It continues. It don't change.
Hi, we're hearing you. Go ahead.
It continues. What we really need is some people power. And that is why politicians...
So how do we get that? How do we get the people power?
By trying to get people to be honest with themselves, mm-hmm. to be truthful with themselves, Randy Pardew, you support doing nonsense. So, and I heard a call in there, Wesley, and they must give me credit for this. If you can put politicians to investigate politicians, you can put the police to investigate the police. Huh? And you've been set up for a long time. Nothing is going to happen. You were looking for a man for career to break. But a man can wear millions and some investigations to get before the law court.
Right.
There's a lot of things that happen about here. And until we have this mindset to recognize wrong where we say wrong, and have the ability to say that it is wrong, nothing is going to change.
Okay. Well, thank you for that intervention. We are going to take a break now for the news. This is Brass Tacks Sunday. Good afternoon. This is Brass Tacks Sunday. I am Christina Hines, and today our producer and technical operator is Mr. Dennis Johnson, and we have a panel comprising Crystal Howell, Matthew Aubrey, Ronnie Yearwood, and Cynthia Barrow-Giles. We have been discussing corruption and integrity mechanisms for Barbados and the Caribbean. I know some of you have some things to say, panelists, but I wanted to ask you, there are some questions that I think indicate some of the uncertainty that people have as to what corruption is. So in the WhatsApp chat, there are some questions. One person asks, if there is someone who offers to provide you duty-free inside of a store, they're working in the store, and they offer to get you duty-free. You are not a traveler, you're not a tourist, but they allow you to get this. Is this corruption? There's another question, which is, if there is a doctor working as a consultant in the hospital, and this person has a private practice, and they are using the facilities and the equipment at the hospital to treat their private patients, perhaps in an expedited manner, is this corruption? I think people are still not quite certain as to what constitutes corruption. Where can you find it? Can you find corruption in a store on Broad Street where someone is offering you duty-free when you're not supposed to get it? Is that corruption, or is that some other kind of unethical practice or law breaking? The instance with physicians, I know, is one that troubles some people. Is this corruption? Is this regular activity? What kinds of practices are these? Any thoughts?
Go ahead.
Well, somebody can go. Go ahead, Ms. Barrow-Giles.
I'm sorry, Christina. I think these are sort of, perhaps in my mind, two different contrasting illustrations. The first one is a little more dicey. And why I say the first one is a little more dicey is largely because normally we assume that there's a relationship between the briber and the bribee. In this case, I'm not sure if a bribe is being paid other than somebody's offering a service. To me, it borders on illegality. It's a violation of the law, because the government has made it very clear that when you're buying something in a store, which also has a duty-free component to it, that you have to pay taxes. So in a sense, you are robbing the state of valuable resources which they can use in order to help us in terms of infrastructural development, whether it be for health or education, etc. In infrastructure, that is what I'm referring to. The second one is very clear. The second one is a case of corruption. The reality is that, remember what our definition of corruption, and all of us were very clear that when we talk about corruption, we are saying that is abuse of office. There's something up there. We talk about influence peddling. We talk about kinds of both the conflict of interest as well as the abuse of office. You are taking advantage of your job in order for you to derive benefits for yourself. So that is a clear illustration. I mean, there is no if, buts, whens, or hows about this particular one. The first one, as I said, is a little more dicey than the second one.
Okay.
But this actually brings home why education is so important, because of these kinds of questions. And we're not supposed to assume that because you put a definition in legislation that persons are going to get it. It doesn't mean that because you even have a code of conduct, if we have a code of conduct, that you're going to just say we have one and not ensure that staff have read it and understand it. even if you do training, it's not supposed to be a one-off exercise where you can say, oh, every year we do training or we sign codes of conduct. And this is the point that I really wanted to drive home, that a lot of the times, this is why I keep saying that the legislation is supposed to be the easy part, because when it comes to these other matters, these other vehicles that we have to use to hit home integrity, they're much more difficult because they have to be ongoing. You can't say that I made my staff sign code of acknowledgement forms that they've read the code of conduct and I've conducted training annually and say that that's enough to fight against corruption when you've had decades and decades of persons not understanding that the practices they engage in actually constitute some form of corruption or poor ethics or whatever the case may be. You have to be able to define these. You have to be able to give very practical examples so that persons can connect the dots mm-hmm. between the definitions in the legislation and the practices that they engage in. And we need to start doing these things now. You do not have to wait on the legislation to develop code of conduct policies and practices. You do not have to wait on the legislation to start training your staff to recognize examples of corruption, bribery, fraud, all of these different areas. And you do not have to wait on the legislation to give different mechanisms to make sure that these things are enforced, whether it's by using GIS to put out bulletins and videos and everything else on a regular basis, so that it becomes like one of those annoying ads in your head that when you see something, it pops up to you like, you know, I really shouldn't have been doing this, or I need to change my thinking in what I used to see as a normal practice, because every Barbadian has gone into a duty-free store and gotten a favor. Well, let me not say all, almost everyone has done that and saw absolutely nothing wrong with it. But by not having these discussions and putting it out there into the public space, by the time the legislation is passed, people would hopefully have already started to retrain themselves in right. terms of what corruption is, what bribery is. And the other point that I would like to make sure that we have very clear, when it comes to the standing orders, especially for government workers, this is something that I often have thrown at me when it comes to being able to talk about things that happen in government, where you're not allowed to speak out about your employer being government. What role is that going to play in terms of reconciling in a public servant's mind, seeing something going wrong in the government office, especially when it's some person above them, and having whistleblower protection policies that now make it seem as though, which one is it that I am supposed to go along with? And especially when the reality of this reporting, because you have to have a mechanism to be able to have these reports made that persons trust and can also see that action comes from it, because we need to make sure we avoid the window dressing, which is what happens a lot when we have to put these things into practice. People put things into practice, but they aren't actually doing anything about it, so it loses its value. So even if you had a whistleblower protection program that people can submit reports on what they're seeing happening and their identities are protected and you go the whole nine yards, but then people see that the persons that they know for sure are engaging in these practices continue to have their jobs, continue to progress within the organization, and nothing comes of it, again, it is seen as more window dressing and not as a true effort in terms of turning around bad practices within the workplace, within government, with, regardless of whether it's private or public sector.
So what about the role of the media,
Christina,
in this?
Before you go on, I just want to say, I want to support what Crystal had to say, you know, in, as robustly as I can. Mm-hmm. But I think she also raised an important point in relation to this very difficult situation or space that public servants would in fact find themselves in. The reality is that, yes, public servants have to deal with the fact that there is what we call the secrecy laws. And I guess, of course, in relation to that, also politicians must deal with the situation. So that when we talk about changing laws and putting in on the books whistleblowing legislation, the core tenet of this whistleblowing legislation actually sits very uneasily with what we know about the secrecy laws. And therefore, there is a gap that somehow or the other we have to deal with. And I'm not sure that when we look at the proposed whistleblowing legislation that actually grapples with that issue in the way that it ought to deal with it very frontally. So I just want to put that on the book, but I endorse what Crystal is saying. As I said at the beginning of the program, one of the key things that we have to engage in is education. I noticed that certainly when it comes to my classes at UWI, because I teach on the issue of corruption, well, I teach very briefly on the issue of corruption for my final year students, for instance, that as we begin to talk about corruption and I try to engage the students, I certainly see them very alert to the fact that many of the things they were doing in the past is in fact corrupt. They did not know they were engaging in corruption. That sometimes I even have to say to some of my students, don't say that in the classroom, especially as we're dealing face to face. Don't say that in the classroom because you're actually putting your reputation online. You are just saying that you have, one, broken the laws of Barbados or wherever you come from, and two, that you are a very corrupt individual on the basis of what you were arguing. So that what they said is that they were unaware of those things. No, I tell them that they were unaware of those things. They can actually take that and go back to their friends in the community and discuss it. So sustained education, I think, is one of the critical ingredients to ensuring that we have a less corrupt-driven society, because that is what we are dealing with.
That's also part of the challenge, is how do you institute a new culture when there's been this history of lack of compliance? Like, where's the line in the sand that whatever happened, we're going to get past that, and you know, no harm, no foul, but we're now going to do this going forward. To respond, though, to your call, which the first person's call, which I think is critical, is whether it defines a corruption in one instance or the next, it's actually, it results in the same thing, which is taking money out of citizens' pockets, right? Yes. So that's part of how we have to orient folks back to, why would you get involved in this? What is the direct benefit to you? So in Barbados, it's a 17.5% VAT. We have a 12% VAT, and likely that may increase. That means that folks who don't have a lot, out of every single dollar, they have to take money that they designate. That's money that they're putting to something that is not using that money effectively, right? So money that should be gathered to be put towards the public purse is offsetting the potential of the increase on taxes that you're drawing from citizens. So adopting this measure of integrity, which we, you know, in the best cases, we hope we rise to a standard that we, you know, whether it be morally, you know, from a religious standpoint or what you've been raised as a family or a culture, is one component, and we want to purport that. But we also have to boil down to, why does integrity actually matter on your day to day? Why would you change your behavior? Why would you be comfortable to say, I'm going to wait longer in this line? Why would you be comfortable to say, I'm not going to get as much off this initial purchase, because long term, I will pay for it, and my citizens, my family will pay, my children will pay for it, because we're all overspent in our governments. So boiling it down to very tactical components, that it's about adopting integrity, doing the right thing, even when people are not watching, for the right reasons. That's what we're hoping. We don't want it just to be adherent to a particular code when we're being followed or when we're being monitored or when we're being, you know, overseen, because that's a limited component. We want to imbue, as Crystal said, a way that when we just start to think about it, we realize that taking this action, which might be not necessarily the easiest action or the most immediately satisfying action, that we're responding in a way, because that will start to build in a culture that disincentivizes doing the wrong thing.
So I have a question for you all. I was trying to ask you before, if we're having difficulties with protecting people feel vulnerable in their jobs, whether these are in the public or the private sector, because I can understand how people who are in the private sector perhaps can observe some impropriety between perhaps a company they're working for and maybe a government agency, and they may feel that they cannot speak out about this because they have to keep their job, they have family to feed, and so on. What about the role of the media in terms of whistleblowing? If other things fail, is this a viable option? So you talk about the official internal channels. What about going to a reporter and telling your story of what you have seen somewhere? Is this a mechanism that is worthwhile to use, especially when people don't feel like they can speak freely in their institution?
The media has a huge role in this, but it goes down to, again, people's comfort and capacity. So if you are If you feel like you're going to be recriminated in your business by saying something, going and speaking it out is almost counterintuitive to you know, most cultures, right? Is you would put yourself in a greater risk. If you feel like there's a chance of bringing it forward, you will be able to change things, then you're gonna follow that route. And the media, by and large, have been able to feature these stories. It's going to go down to, again, your individual capacity that you feel like something will change by that mechanism. So for most measures, I think you have to think that there should be multiple spaces, both in a confidential and a private way, but then as a recourse, bringing it publicly. But then publicly, you have to also be comfortable and concerned that there won't be any recriminations for you having done so.